It's Chief of the State of Colorado versus Cedillo Romero. Are both parties ready?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Argument is set for half an hour, 15 minutes per side. What I've said, the first argument I see it, both counsel obviously will hear the entire argument. We should proceed.
May it please the court, Rebecca Adams, registration number 31044. I represent the people in this matter. I also recognize that this is the fourth argument this morning on this issue, so I am happy to answer any additional questions that the court might have. I'm not sure I have anything in addition to offer.
Any other factual distinction that differentiates this case from the others on the ultimate question? I mean, or influences it, or?
No, Your Honor. Yeah. There are no other questions? All right, I will reserve my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jones.
May it please the court, Ms. Jones. My name is Gail Johnson, registration number 29703, and I represent Mr. Montero Romero in this appeal. I'd like to address an assumption that I think is built into some of the questions that have come from various justices this morning, that I think I can offer a different perspective or a different framework for viewing our precedent in this area. And that is the notion that this is somehow a super substantial right that is different from any other state-created right. Respectfully, I think that what McCrander says is that this right and this error is subject to harmless error analysis, but that when certain requirements are met, namely use of a peremptory challenge to strike the juror who should have been excused for cause, as well as number two, exhaustion, under those circumstances, we, the state of Colorado, presume prejudice, and that error affects a substantial right and can never be harmless. And that comes directly from the language of the McCrander case, on 828 P. Second at 244. The court, the literal holding is, we hold, therefore, that the trial court's erroneous ruling on a challenge for cause, which is followed by the defendant's use of a peremptory challenge to remove the suspect juror, and the defendant's exhaustion of all available peremptory challenges, affects the substantial right of the defendant and cannot be deemed harmless error. The court in McCrander, this court in McCrander, also used that harmless error analysis to distinguish the Ross case. Specifically, at page 244, footnote 12 of McCrander. Quote, in contrast to Ross, the issue in the instant case is not whether the jury selected to try the case was impartial in the constitutional sense of that term, but whether the trial court's erroneous ruling on the challenge for cause constituted harmless error or instead affected a substantial right of the defendant, end quote. So I don't think we need to justify the right here as being a particularly elevated right. What I think is different from the outcome determinative, where you look at the trial evidence type of harmless error inquiries, is simply how do we measure whether the substantial right has been denied. So for example, in a case where evidence is erroneously admitted at trial, it makes sense in such a case that you would look at the other body of balance of trial evidence and determine was this important or wasn't it. By contrast, with this type of error, whether it's an McCrander type error where you're being denied a substantial statutory right, or a Lefebvre type error where you're being denied parity with the prosecution in a criminal case, it makes sense that the inquiry is the exhaustion inquiry. Namely, if a defendant had five allotted peremptory challenges and at the end of the day didn't use three of them, that's not reversible error under this court's precedent. And that makes sense, because under such circumstances, the error can be deemed harmless.
What about this idea that there's going to be game playing by defense counsel? And
Your Honor, I think this perhaps comes back to Justice Boatwright's questions this morning as well about, does our case law impact how trial lawyers pick juries? And the fair answer is yes, which is what we want, trial lawyers paying attention to this court's decision. I don't think that that's game plan, but I do think as a matter of policy, when this court anticipates or is faced with a request from the people of the state of Colorado to abandon 100 years of precedent, as a matter of policy, this court should think about what are the practical implications if we were to adopt the prosecution's rule versus what we have now. What we have now is a system that incentivizes but does not require a criminal defendant to curatively exercise a peremptory challenge when he or she believes that a challenge for cause has been erroneously denied. And I would suggest to the court that when we look at the bigger picture here of promoting justice and whether adopting the rule that the prosecution suggests would do more good than harm or harm than good, what promotes justice is precisely what we have now, to incentivize trial lawyers to curatively, to use their peremptory challenges in a curative fashion for the sake of preserving an appealable issue under our precedent and the grand jury of the paper. By contrast, the rule that the prosecution asks this court to adopt will necessarily, I think, as it does in other jurisdictions, cause trial attorneys to allow potentially biased jurors to stand with the teacher. And I don't think that that promotes justice. And I would like to briefly go back to Justice Marquez's early question about the Harris case and whether there was a waiver issue in terms of allowing a potentially biased juror to sit on the jury and not exercising a peremptory curative. The Harris case is very distinguishable because the statutory basis for challenge was permissive but not mandatory. The facts of that case involved a statute that allowed excusal of a juror or a possible challenge for cause, not mandatory, for prior jury service. And so it had to do with the convenience of the jury and I think spreading out the civic duty. It did not have to do with either implied bias or actual bias. Similarly, the Harris case very much relied upon the fact that in that case, the defendant had not exhausted several of its peremptory challenges, so clearly there was no prejudice, which is in line with all of our precedent.
Counsel, can I just get you to stop there and address what did the world look like before McCrander? I mean, in the sense that I think you said we're looking at 100 years of precedent, but that early 1911 case was a civil case. So that I'm trying to figure out what happened, how did the world work before McCrander? The day before McCrander?
And Your Honor, I wasn't practicing law then, so I'm not sure.
Well, no, I understand that, but that's where you're leading us, I think, is this rule has, I guess your position is it's worked very well. And I'm wondering if you can help us understand what a world without McCrander would look like.
Sure. I think in a world without McCrander, here's the choice that the trial lawyer faces. Trial lawyer believes that a challenge for cause to a biased juror has been erroneously denied. On a case-by-case basis, taking into account all sorts of factors that are at play in the trial, that counsel is then going to make a decision. Is it more important and more helpful to this client to strike that juror for the peremptory? Because I believe they're biased and take whatever else is going to happen with this jury in terms of new people coming into the box? Or do I believe so strongly that I'm going to win that appellate issue, notwithstanding the laughter earlier when someone suggested that, that I'm going to essentially leave that juror on and take to win on appeal, again, take my chances at trial, and if I lose, I know I have a Sixth Amendment claim on appeal. Nothing about that regime is going to reduce litigation. It is going to the contrary, it's going to cause these cases to last forever into federal habeas, because everyone, I think it's fair to say, this court probably knows from its docket that the cases that are coming up are McCrander cases. They're not Sixth Amendment fair and impartial jury cases, because this court's precedent has incentivized the defense community in the state to strike, to curatively exercise their peremptory challenges, to strike jurors who they believe should have been challenged for cause. That will change if this court were to abandon its precedent. The court wants some fewer cases. I think the court will see instead constitutional cases under both the state and federal constitution instead of the common law and statutory cases that the court is seeing now.
Given where the, what we've been arguing about all day, where the U.S. Supreme Court and federal cases have gone with regard to constitutional matters here, I'm not sure I understand why you think if we departed from the rule with regard to Colorado's statutes and the interpretation session, why would it be faced with a bigger constitutional problem?
Because the Supreme Court in Martinez-Salazar expressly said that they were rejecting the people's position in that case, that if you don't exercise the peremptory challenge, you can't then raise a Sixth Amendment claim. So what the court has held in Martinez-Salazar is that a Sixth Amendment claim consistent with our decision in Morrison can be preserved by allowing a potentially biased juror to sit on the jury.
So you're referring to a challenge to just strictly the error in denying a challenge for cause. That's the nature of the Sixth Amendment challenge you're talking about, is it?
It becomes a Sixth Amendment fair and impartial jury claim instead of...
But see, I thought, and let me just pursue this a second, but I thought the basis of those determinations in Martinez-Salazar and also Rivera was, I mean, sort of the premise where we started from was the juror as to whom an erroneous ruling on a challenge for cause had been made has now been removed from the jury for a different reason. So we wouldn't have a problem with that juror sitting and causing a biased juror, right?
If they're removed, that's correct. But there is no requirement that they be removed. And in fact, the Supreme Court has said, as a matter of federal constitutional law, there is no requirement.
So the thrust of your thinking is, if we were to change McCrandeer, then the defense counsel would not remove them and would leave them on and take a chance and then be able to raise an appellate issue?
Precisely. The only caveat I would give, Your Honor, is that sometimes they would and sometimes they wouldn't. It's going to be case specific and it's going to depend on the individual attorney, I'm sure.
Ms. Johnson, can I follow up with that? Is there any rule that or holding that we could make that we could have peremptory challenges be used for the purpose for which they're designed, and that is to try and get a fair and impartial jury? I mean, it's like respond this way for purpose of appeal, and instead of what the purpose of the peremptory challenge is to have sort of that, for whatever reason, I don't like that person, they haven't said something, but I'm going to bump them. I mean, as a trial lawyer, you do that all the time, you kind of rely on your gut. Is there any holding a rule that we can fashion that would get us back to what peremptory challenges are for?
Your Honor, I think the system we have does that. And I think the case law recognizes this right to shape the jury and that it should be an equal right. But for example, there are cases that sometimes arise where defense counsel may not exhaust. And that is understandably a product of individual decision-making in an individual case based on the circumstances faced by the trial lawyer. Most trial lawyers would say, as was said earlier, you should be focusing on trying to win a trial, not on appeal.
But that doesn't always happen.
But I don't think it's gamesmanship to exhaust your peremptories. I think it's actually, exhausting your peremptories is fairly in line with shaping the jury the way you see fit. I mean, most trial lawyers, I think, with or without McCrandeer, exhaust peremptories, unless there's some good reason not to, but I think those instances are thrice few and far between.
Could I ask one more specific question about the language? Do you see anything, we haven't actually, any of us talked about it that much, in the language of the rule or the statute that would lend itself to a reading that it entitles a defense to a non-curative peremptory challenge or simply a peremptory challenge? And where I'm going with that is, does our rationale and McCrandeer primarily derive with regard to the curative right or non-curative right, does that derive entirely from a century-old civil case that predated our statute and rule, or is there something more about the statute and rule that was involved in our formulation of the principle that way?
Your Honor, I think how I would answer the question is this. The state of Colorado has never had a requirement of curative use in the way that some other places might. And Instead, what we have is, you know, if you want to preserve an appealable issue here, you need to curatively use, which is a distinction that's important. It's an incentive, but it's not a requirement.
But presumably, but the rationale for that we're talking about from McCrander is that the defendant is entitled to a certain number of non-curative peremptories. And if he's deprived of one of those, then he's been deprived of an important right. But where does it come from that the defendant is entitled to non-curative peremptories?
Your Honor, I would suggest that it's the absence of any written requirement in the statute. And that's a choice the legislature made long ago. And that's a choice that, as was alluded to earlier, the legislature has not changed in all these many years, 21 years now since McCrander, and then another 13 years since Lefebvre.
Okay.
Counsel, going back to your first comment about looking at this as a substantial right that we apply harmless error to, and simply when a certain number of criteria are met, we presume prejudice. How do we square that with all the rest of our harmless error jurisprudence? We're talking about non-constitutional trial errors. When we talk about how it affects that substantial right, we examine that in terms of its impact on the verdict, the outcome of the proceedings. And all I can see is that we trace this all the way back to the Kennedy case. We made a lengthy comment in there suggesting that what impact this would have had would be a matter of pure conjecture. We have no idea. And if that's true, then how do we square that with the requirement in order to reverse the conviction, we do have to find that it somehow impacted or influenced the verdict in some way. I'm just trying to resolve that tension in this construct and mesh why we treat this so differently than every other formal reason.
And I see my time has expired. May I respond?
You certainly may.
Your Honor, but I think it's because the right to exercise peremptory challenges in a posture of parity with the prosecution is the right at issue here. And that's different from evidence coming in a trial and requires a different analysis. And the fundamental fairness underlying that, I think, was reflected this morning. When Ms. Jones got up for rebuttal argument, Chief Justice Bender gave her an additional 1 minute and 20 seconds, because we all recognize that that's what's fair. And similarly, that's, you know, we have two ways of formulating this right. McCrander talks about the statutory allotment, and Lefebvre talks about parity with the prosecution, because otherwise there would be an unfair tactical advantage, which presumptively impairs a defendant's right to use language.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Jones.
Thank you.
Ms. Jones, you have another 1 minute and 29 seconds. You're 14:26.
Now, I think McCrander does specifically acknowledge that it rejects harmless error analysis. In fact, it says we acknowledge some tension between our rejection of harmless error analysis and our decision in another case. And again, if the court had been looking at this through the lens of harmless error analysis, it would have had to look at how this affected the fairness of the trial proceedings, at the outcome of the proceedings, and whether this had an impact.
What do you do with Lefebvre where it says presumed prejudice because of the imbalance?
Well, again, I think that goes directly against our harmless error analysis in Colorado in every other sense. We always look at, in order to determine whether something's a substantial right, we first have to determine whether it impacted the fairness of the trial proceedings or whether it affected the outcome of the proceedings. We don't simply skip to whether or not this is a substantial right. So the way in which the language is used in McCrander really seems to elevate this to more of a structural error than harmless error, because it's not looking at the outcome of the impact. It's simply looking at the fact that they can't determine whether or not there was any impact here. And that's kind of what we do in structural error analysis. But before we get to that step, we first have to decide whether or not the error affected the reliability of the truth-finding function. So even when we're looking at structural error, we have to look at that. And here, of course, we don't have that. because by all accounts, the defendant was tried by a fair and impartial jury. Now again, when we talk about the McCrandon rule that we have here, we have a situation where the defendant has no reason not to exhaust his peremptory challenges and appeal the trial court's denial of his challenge for cause. He's been able to excuse the challenged juror with a peremptory, so he has his fair and impartial jury, and then he's able to challenge on appeal that the trial court was wrong, and if he was convicted, now all of a sudden he gets a new trial with a new fair and impartial jury. If the rule were to change, defense counsel is assuming that other defense counsel are going to leave a biased juror on, risk a conviction in the hopes that maybe they would win on appeal and then have another trial by a fair and impartial jury, when in fact they could have just dismissed the juror for cause with a peremptory and had a fair and impartial jury the first time. So again, and this court could decide that, you know, peremptory challenges shall be used curatively. That gets you your fair and impartial jury. But there's nothing about the statute that requires anything with respect to how the peremptory challenges are used. The only thing that the statute provides is the number of challenges that each side gets. And this is very similar to Martinez-Salazar, where the federal rule doesn't say how they're supposed to be used either. But in Martinez-Salazar, the U.S. Supreme Court said that they don't have to be used curatively, but they certainly can be. And when they are, there's no error. Again, really what we want from these peremptory challenges is for the defendant to receive a trial by a fair and impartial jury. And that's what all of the defendants in all of these cases today have. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the defendant's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank both attorneys for your arguments, your briefs. The case will be submitted on the briefs, and the court will take a recess until 1:30 this afternoon.